Number four. Win Scott versus Potter.
May it please the court, Ms. Lyon Scott and myself are pleased to address the court and distinguished panel. Before addressing the merits of the case, there's an issue about the court's jurisdiction. Defendant maintains that plaintiff's Rule 59 motion did not adequately state grounds for reconsideration, so that the filing of the notice of appeal after resolution of the Rule 59 motion and the consideration of the pleadings by the district court, the notice of appeal, therefore, was not timely. I suggest three reasons why the motion to dismiss must be denied. First, because the trial court raised sua sponte and decided the issue of plaintiff's racially hostile work environment claim in its December 28th memorandum opinion and order, that was procedurally inappropriate because the consideration sua sponte without notice under 56C deprived plaintiff an opportunity to present the fact and legal argument concerning that claim. Therefore, I think the court was really trying to correct that. The distinguished judge was trying to correct that and give us the opportunity in considering that claim, because he notes that the parties did not adequately address this. I noted in my brief that wasn't addressed by the defendant at all in its summary judgment motion. Therefore, what really happened is that the court's February 21st memorandum opinion order was the first procedurally proper final order of the court, and therefore the notice of appeal would be timely, as long as you interpret that sequence of events in that fashion. Secondly, I would note that while my Rule 59 motion on behalf of Ms. Lyon Scott may not be a model for such motions, it did state ground for reconsideration in there, including two or three different issues, and I asked leave to supplement that in a subsequent filing. But the court granted me leave to do, and that was done, and the court did consider it. That was filed within the 10-day period, and there are cases that hold that as long as the Rule 59 motion stating some grounds are filed within the 10 days, the court has the inherent authority to allow amendments to those grounds. And so I would cite the court to the Pate versus Seaboard decision, 819 F. 2nd, 1074, and the Pogue decision, I cite, in my response to the motion to dismiss. The third basis for denying the motion. Well, therefore, the Rule 59 motion did state the ground, did defer the time for filing the notice of appeal, and therefore the notice of appeal that was filed was timely. The third response to the motion to dismiss is that even if you assume that the initial motion under Rule 59 was not adequately stated, that under the decision in Thompson versus INS, the U.S. Supreme Court decision, where the court makes the assumption that it has been properly filed, there's no objection by the defendant, we proceed on the basis that there was a properly filed motion for reconsideration, it considers the grounds stated in the subsequently filed memorandum and makes a decision, it is indicated to the parties that everything is fine and that the time for filing an appeal, notice of appeal, would be deferred until after the resolution of that motion. We got so far as filing the notice of appeal, filing our brief, and not until they filed their responsive brief did they make the motion to dismiss this appeal. Now, under those circumstances, I think clearly the Thompson versus INS decision applies, and therefore this would be considered a timely filing under those circumstances. Now, as to the merits, Your Honor, basically we have presented the case on appeal as a racially hostile work environment case. We have, under the Harris versus Forklift Systems case, I don't believe I have enough time to go through all the facts of the case. I've set them forth in my brief. Certainly,
that's usually the procedure.
I'm sorry. But Your Honor understands that you have de novo review. I'm sure you know the legal standards as far as granting summary judgment. I don't have to go through that.
If we don't, we've got a lot of problems.
Okay, well, then I won't go through it, but it's only where no reasonable jury could have found a plaintiff was not the victim of discriminatory actions would the grant of summary judgment be appropriate for defendants.
Now, it's true in this case that Ms. Scott never complained about him in terms of harassment because of race. I mean, she made it clear, you know, she relayed some of those comments that he made and the problems that she had, but she didn't state it that clearly.
Well, you have to understand that both of the incidents involved racial taunts, epithets, or claims that he was being discriminated. She was a racist MF, this is racial BS, this is, you're a black bitch. I mean, all those comments make it very clear on his face that he's got something going on, and man, this person was mentally impaired. Mm-hmm. He had a traumatic brain injury. He was a dangerous person. And if you look at Mr. Anderson, the Caucasian manager, he acknowledges this person was dangerous to the facility and to Ms. Lynn Scott herself. And whether or not she made a complaint about it, she made a complaint that she was scared stiff of this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, the fact that his motivation was race. I mean, they had a zero tolerance policy. He was on a last chance agreement. How they could ever put him back is beyond my comprehension. And how
what
they could do it.
What additional steps could the Postal Service have taken
to
end the harassment other than discharging him and taking into consideration discharging him within the law of a person with a disability?
Well, first of all, he was not a qualified handicapped individual. He probably had no claim. If they wanted to settle it because they were fearful of some claim, I'm not denying the agency the privilege to do that. But first of all, before they brought him back, I think they were duty-bound to do a psychiatric evaluation. What they did there was no psychiatric evaluation. If you look at my brief, I set forth what Dr. White didn't know, wasn't even aware of the two specifics of the incidents, wasn't aware that she had been attacked by him, wasn't aware that he'd taken swings at another black supervisor when they tried to accost him to get him to leave the facility. She wasn't aware of any of that. She basically didn't do her responsibility. She didn't examine him. She never saw him. She basically repeated what a psychologist hired by Mr. Now's mother submitted to the agency, and she rewrote that and said he's okay psychiatrically. And I think that was negligent to bring him back in the first place. But if you look at what happened when they brought him back, it was not reasonably calculated and harassment. Why? My client made it very clear she could not work with him. She broke down in the offices of Ms. Kelly in the presence of Mr. Anderson. Just had an emotional breakdown. I can't work with him. They ignored that. They were originally going to put him back on her shift, on her unit, but instead they put him back in the same shift, on the same department, in the mail prep, meter breakup shift, working the same time. Where he
off
was
on a different floor, though?
A different floor where he was free to work.
But on a different floor, not
right
the same
below
area.
Her desk, where you walk up a half a flight of stairs and stare right at her desk. And what happened was, she was unnerved. He came back to his unit on a regular basis, and then she went to them and asked for a two-month detail in writing on August 8th and said, I cannot work with this individual. I have to get out. And after that, she went to her doctor and psychologically just...
What is your damage claim here? You want to be compensated for the 2 months? Is that
Her claim is there are two aspects of the claim. The pecuniary loss is the 3 months she was off, which is not insubstantial. She was not paid for that time, but she also has compensatory damages that she's entitled to under the Civil Service Reform Act of 1991. But that, you know, we have not addressed the allegation. And we're not talking about mega dollars here, but we're talking about somebody who looked for the protection of her employer. They didn't believe that she was really psychologically impaired. Excuse me, I just want to take 1 second to make
this point. Can you speak to this question? Because when he comes back to work and he's on a different floor and he starts staring at her, does she ever bring that to the attention of someone in the post office before, you know, her walking out, you know, because of these issues and how difficult it was? Does she ever tell any supervisor, you know, this guy's coming up, he's staring at me? Was that in the record anywhere? Was there any evidence of that?
Yes, not in that precise way, but she went to them and said, I can't work with this man in the facility. Can you detail me to another facility for at least a temporary period?
Right.
On
the
fourth
day
he was back.
At that time, did she tell them that he was staring at that he was coming up staring at her?
The record is not complete on exactly what was stated at that time, Your Honor. I mean, I can't say that it substantiates that they knew he was, they guaranteed her they would follow monitor her his conduct closely, his
right.
activities closely.
I understand.
That they failed to do, he was seen unrebuttedly in her unit, and staring at her on a repeated basis. So they weren't fulfilling their responsibility. And they knew that he, in his deep dark recesses of his mind, harbored racial animosity toward my client.
Right.
And my client,
my only question is, did they know he was staring at her? At, you know, was that brought to their attention? That's all I'm trying
I wish to say that the record was better on that. You know, I didn't take her deposition. I wish we brought it out. But it's not in the record.
Okay.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. I'd like to start just with responding to your question, Ms. Williams. There was no evidence in the record that she made any such complaints to management at the postal facility. And in fact, there's nobody at the postal facility that was writing a brief for Greg now at that point. You know, they were faced with a very tough business decision about how to deal with this problem employee when it was clear that his supervisor didn't have any understanding about the nature of his disability and wasn't making any effort to engage in an interactive process with him. So they had a tough call to make there. Nobody wanted to bring Greg Now back to work, and she was specifically assured by her supervisor, and this is in the record, that if there were any problems with Now, they would take steps to deal with it, and they would make sure she didn't have future problems with Now. So she had no reason to believe that if she had brought that to the attention of management, it would have been ignored. You know, she left, and the supposition of the manager there was that she was incapacitated, and you know, he didn't understand details of it beyond that. You know, she had been offered the opportunity to go and work on a different shift herself, which she could have done. So by her not showing up at work, the reasonable inference was that she wasn't able to work, not that they didn't have a way to divine that it was based on specific problems with Mr.
Well, as he was the one with the problem, why wouldn't he work a different shift? Why should she work a different shift?
Well, Your Honor, I think that goes to a business judgment to be made by the Postal Service. I think that you can easily make that argument on behalf of Ms. Scott, and I think it's a legitimate argument to say, you know, the Postal Service felt that they were taking adequate steps to address the issue by moving him to a different floor of the building under a different supervisor. And they didn't have any reason to believe that that wouldn't be adequate to prevent future problems between the two of them. You know, future problems would presumably be directed at his new supervisor, who would be the one to be calling him to task in case he did anything.
And ultimately
wrong.
That happened because he...
That's right. And ultimately, you know, nobody had any reason to believe that future misconduct by Now would be tolerated, and in fact it wasn't. But at that point, you know, they had their bases covered and they didn't have to worry about being up here in front of you defending a lawsuit brought by Mr. Now, which I wouldn't want to be in the position of defending under the circumstances that they didn't have any understanding of the nature of his disability or were making any steps to accommodate it.
What about counsel's argument that it was inadequate, the psychiatric review of Now at the time, you know, after the first incident arose and he was fired?
I think the answer to that is that the decision to bring Mr. Now back was made by Mr. Anderson, the manager at the facility, who was fully aware of the details of everything that happened. The psychiatric evaluation wasn't done by the Postal Service doctor at all. She didn't do anything. She basically got a report from Mr. Now's psychiatrist that set forth the nature of his disability and things that could be done to accommodate it and make it better for him to work. So if any evaluation was done, it was done by a treating psychologist or psychiatrist who presumably was aware that Now had been fired and, you know, that his behavior had risen to the level that he was fired
but
by the post office.
Is there anything in the record that shows that the psychiatrist was aware of what he had said to his supervisors and to Scott and some of those incidents?
No, there's not. And clearly the Postal Service doctor wasn't aware of the details. But as I said, the call was made by Mr. Anderson, who was aware of those details, and it was a business judgment on his part. And you know, I think you can quarrel, you can make arguments on both sides about, you know, whether the Postal Service adopted the perfect response here, whether they should have given more consideration to Ms. Scott in this case. But ultimately, the decision that they made and the steps they took were reasonably calculated to put an end to conflict between the two of them. And a case we cited in our brief, Savino versus C.P. Hall, this court addressed the exact same remedy that was adopted here, namely moving the employee, the harasser, alleged harasser, to a different supervisor in a different part of the facility, and said that that was reasonably calculated. I think before getting into the merits of the case, this court's faced with the jurisdictional issue, which we raised in a motion to dismiss and in our brief. And I'll just briefly address the issues that Mr. White mentioned this morning. The first thing he seemed to talk about was the fact that there was action on the merits of the motion taken by the district court, and indeed on issues that hadn't been fleshed out by the parties earlier in the case. But you know, the cases that we cited, clearly, you know, that's something that was present in many of those cases as well. And indeed, after we filed our brief in this case, this court issued the decision in Tolano versus Northwestern Medical Faculty Foundation, which really is on all fours with this case right down the line. Similarly, his argument that he stated some grounds in his motion isn't borne out by a review of the motion itself. I mean, he does state in there that there are factual and legal matters that are overlooked, but this court in the Tolano case addressed a motion that had similar sorts of reasons that were stated in the motion and found those to be inadequate to provide the specificity required by the rule. In that case, the movement had argued that the court misapplied fundamental principles, failed to apply other well-recognized principles, and is in conflict with precedent of the Seventh Circuit construing Illinois state contract law.
Is this appeal timely when taken in consideration with the denial of the plaintiff's motion for reconsideration?
Well, it turned out that the way you addressed this in the Tolano case was just the way we set it out in our brief. And the answer is it could arguably be timely, but only from a motion that would be construed as a Rule 60B motion. And if you want to construe his motion as a Rule 60B motion, then the appeal could be timely in that way. But his motion wasn't one which was proffered under that rule and didn't state grounds as set forth in that rule.
And so, tell us why it didn't state grounds.
Well, the under Rule 60B, you're limited to issues concerning fraud, or I've got those stated in my brief. In this case, he's basically just asking the court to go back to issues which the court had considered in its earlier decision. So there was none of the fundamental miscarriages that are referred to in Rule 60B that would make that appealable. And of course, even if it were appealable, the standard of review under Rule 60B is extremely deferential, and the district court's decision was not an abuse of discretion.
And that memorandum in support that he submitted 14 days later, your position is that was too late?
Yes, Your Honor, it was, and that's right in accord with the holding of this court most recently in Tolano and the other cases that we cited in the brief. We submit that if the court does address the merits of the appeal, that the district court's decision was correct for three reasons. In the first place, this wasn't a case of race harassment. You know, what this case is about is an employer who is faced with a very difficult business decision about how to deal with a mentally handicapped employee who is unruly and insubordinate.
What about his comments that all the statements he made about Scott were of a racial nature?
Right, but I think that's a very important point that I want to make, is that the counsel for the appellant has misrepresented the record in his brief and here also. On the incident in question, May 2 of 1997, there were no racial epithets used by now. What he did was he accused his supervisor, Ms. Scott, of being racist. and about picking on him because he was, in his words, a skinny white boy. And he didn't use any racial epithets at all. And there was no, you know, on that occasion, touching of her. There was no threatening of her. He did kick apart a mail can, but that was it. And so there just wasn't a racial element to that harassment. Nobody at the post office viewed it as a question of racial harassment against Scott. You know, this is a case about what to do about Greg now. And the evidence in the record, according to the complaint and according to the testimony of Ms. Scott at her deposition, was that Greg now was a person who, due to his mental problems, was prone to violent outbursts against everybody, employees, supervisors, white and black alike. You know, he was, in the words of the district court, he was basically an equal opportunity pain. And nobody's writing any brief for Greg now, but it was a tough business decision for the Postal Service to make about how to deal with it. Similarly, well, based on the arguments in our brief and what we've said here this morning, we'd ask the court either dismiss the appeal for lack of jurisdiction or affirm the decision of the district court.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you. You're out of your time. We will give you a 30-second. You are out of it, though.
Understand? You can ask some questions. This is not a difficult business decision. All they had to do was listen to the doctor, who, even after the fact, said they had to be separated. They refused to acknowledge that and separate him so she could come back to work. Secondly, all this consideration of Mr. Now, all this tough stuff, he didn't even have a discrimination case pending. He didn't have any claim. They could have defended that very easily. But the fact is, the consideration, she was barred from any involvement in the decision to bring him back, which was the policy.
Well, why should she be called in?
Because it's the policy. Excuse me, I'm sorry.
The complainant should be called in to see whether they should bring someone back?
It has been
for the government?
Your Honor, she's a member of management, and she is
routinely,
the policy in the record, I don't want to argue with you, in the record.
Do you think that she might be biased?
No, but she might be able to present the best person to say what happened at the event. See, what happened is they had a meeting of 8 Caucasian people, none of whom talked about what happened at the incident, and it was all hidden under the rug, and so the consideration of her as a black supervisor was not properly given. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you kindly. Thank you. We will proceed.